Anchored is a production of the Classic Learning Test. Based in Annapolis, Maryland, reconnecting knowledge and virtue through meaningful assessments. Visit us at cltexam.com/get-started.
Welcome back to the Anchored Podcast. This is Noah Tyler, CFO at CLT, as a guest host this week. Very excited to welcome a special guest, Dr. Clara Piano. Clara is currently an assistant professor of economics at Austin P. State University in Clarksville, Tennessee. She holds a PhD in economics from George Mason University, where I also attended in the same department. Her primary areas of research are family economics, the economics of religion, and political economy. She recently read a wonderful piece for Public Discourse on the importance of including economics in a classical curriculum, which we'll be discussing today. Beyond economics, Clara enjoys reading and discussing Catholic social thought. Welcome, Clara.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So we'll begin this podcast where we begin all of our podcasts, better understanding the educational formation of our guests. So were you publicly educated, homeschooled, and especially how did you fall into this amazing science of economics?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll try to tell the short version because I've actually been to almost every kind of school since we moved a lot growing up. But I'm very lucky to have parents who care a lot about education. So they always did their research whenever we'd move to a new place on what was the best school in the area. And they're both devout Catholics, but also successful business people. And so they wanted to make sure that there is a good balance at that school of, you know, Catholic school if possible, but also, you know, really they favored classical education. You know, if you do your research, you tend to end up there. Mm-hmm. So I was really fortunate. I'd say one of the most influential schools that I went to was, it's called Holy Family Academy in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. And that was a classical Catholic school, daily mass. And I think the real difference and the real reason why I appreciated that education so much was that the professors, the teachers really treated us as intellectual beings, as people with an intellectual life. And that was the difference that I noticed in some of the different schools that I attended, how it came to economics. So I just loved reading and writing. I really wanted to be like an Agatha Christie when I grew up and went to college. So I really don't think I would have found economics if it wasn't for both my parents and their example as business people, but also this couple of economists, the Drs. Thomases, who I met when I was at college at Creighton University. And they just were such a team, and they started all of these opportunities on campus, brought in speakers like Father Sirico from the Acton Institute. They started a reading group on Catholic social thought, which I was already interested at that point because I love John Paul II. And so I got to do some hands-on research on school choice. It was just all so great. And it was one of those moments when I think it was pretty late actually in my college career. And I just knew with certainty, you know, this is what I'm called to do. This is really my professional vocation. And so that brought me to the point where I went straight into the PhD program at George Mason and have been enjoying being an economics professor ever since.
That's amazing. And we'll get into your understanding of economics. But I wonder, especially as you're talking about economics belonging in the classical setting, let's start actually with defining economics. What's the best understanding of what lines we can draw around this? Is it a social science? Is it a hard science? There's a lot of even confusion over this question of what is economics. So let's start there and then we'll get into the further parts of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like every science, I think it's both a science and an art. And it definitely deals with social phenomena. And it's definitely deals a lot more with people, I think, than the average student. Certainly than I realized before I really started taking economics courses and reading economics. It's not about, you know, money or just data and things like that, although we do study those things and use that in our research. But I like the definition of James Buchanan, actually. And so he said economics is the study of the whole system of exchange relationships, or even simply understood the way that we depend on one another. And that's always been really an important piece of economics for me, is that it what it kind of helps us see about the world is how interdependent we are and how connected we are and how beautiful actually that is. And then that leads us, you know, to things like the price system and supply and demand and a lot of other things that economists are well known for. But it really depends on that, this fact that we can't do it alone. And so we have to depend on the talents of other people.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's something in your biography and in something in that definition where there must have been some point where it kind of gripped you. And you can see this in the article you wrote as well, which will be linked in the show notes, that you're expressing something is beautiful here. It's not just that there's an interesting thing that can help us functionally, but there's something beautiful. Can you describe a beautiful moment of discovery where you read a text and it came alive and you realized something about the world, a dimension that you discovered? Can you give us some flavor of what that looked like for you?
Absolutely. Yeah. So just, I think that way of approaching knowledge, and this is actually kind of from Pope Benedict, this idea that we have to love something to fully understand it. And I mean, this is a very, very classical understanding of really, again, this intellectual life that I tell my students, my job is to make you fall in love with economics. And I want to recover that right in education. Mm-hmm. And it's possible in economics. Some people are like, you know, maybe can't see it initially. But for me, it happened, oh gosh, in a lot of ways. I think from a reading perspective. So I remember very early on reading things like iPencil, which is just a very simple essay about how many people contribute to making a pencil, something that seems very simple, but it's not, and how beautiful that is. I was always really drawn to thinking about like international, because I grew up, part of my childhood was overseas. So about the way that, countries work together, how, you know, something in my house could have been made, you know, by someone so far away. But I the example that's freshest in my mind is actually, I gave birth to my first child, a daughter, 2 summers ago now. And once I had a child, and I remember postpartum, I got like a grocery delivery. And that again, made me, you know, see with fresh eyes, you know, how important it was for me to depend on other people and how marvelous it was that people are sitting in their offices thinking up ways to serve my needs as a mother. So what baby carrier would be useful for me, you know, things like this, so they can sell me those products. That was just a beautiful experience thinking about all of the people who are contributing to my raising of my daughter. And then
that's amazing.
Yeah. And then just a text that I come back to often that I'd say really shapes my thinking and that I would recommend to any of the listeners is a short article by Friedrich Hayek called The Use of Knowledge in Society. I think that's one of the most accessible and one of just the most genius and absolutely groundbreaking, really, texts in economics that for a lot of economists, myself included, we return to, and it helps us understand, you know, this experience of economic wonder. And again, this emphasis on the fact that none of us know other people's needs better than we know our own and that of our families. And so how we all work together to serve our own needs and our families in the process of serving others.
That's a beautiful article, one that we'll also link to. I think for me, Economic Harmonies by Bastiat was on the same theme of iPencil, use of knowledge in society. It's this whole interrelated network, how Paris gets fed. It's just, it's one of the key insights, and it's something that I think we should be bringing to our secondary level classical schools. So let's turn to that article. And it took me maybe 3 readings to realize that you'd organized it according to true, good, and beautiful. So I was a little dense at first. I'm like, just great article. And then I was like, wait a minute, the headings here have some significance. So maybe let's start with economics as true. What kind of true, what kind of epistemology underlies economics? Is it something that you just go out in the field and see? Is there some kind of a logical structure that you infer, you know, in the ivory tower and then kind of apply to the world? And to what extent is maybe economics revealed that kind of God inspires us to understand economics. So what kind of truth should we be thinking of as we bring this to students?
Yeah, so another good question. When I say economics is true, I mean that economics and a lot of the assumptions that we have about reality correspond to reality. So I think that, and you brought up different examples of truth, which is always helpful to remember. And I also try to emphasize this in the classroom that, you know, the scientific method is not the only, you know, of attaining or way to attain truth. But in economics, we do focus on things like the scientific method, empirical, you know, facts, truths, things like this, trying to understand economic facts, right? So what is something like the unemployment rate or, you know, what is the poverty rate, things like that. But there's also a really important logical component. And so I think that's probably what people miss initially, but when professors talk about the economic way of thinking, this is what we mean, that we really make claims like humans choose purposefully, or, you know, scarcity will always be with us, right? There's no solutions, only trade-offs. These types of things that are meant to just be sort of logically true, to describe reality, to correspond with reality. And so I think that that's another way that economics is true. And then in a revealed sense, I think, you know, if you bring, I'm part of some organizations, the Association of Christian Economists, the Catholic Research Economists Association. And so these are conversations we have often, which is, you know, if you bring your faith into economics and you can see sort of providence and divine providence working in the background. And I do think it enlivens the discipline and helps you see things that you wouldn't otherwise. And so we can kind of, you know, say that's true in all of these ways, but really the way that it specializes amongst, right, the other sciences, I would say is mostly logical and empirical.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Thank you. And turning from true to the good, some would say that if we run all of our systems and all of our understanding of the world through the lens of economics, you know, then we're all alienated and we're all atomized and, you know, maybe it's not good. Maybe economics should just stick to its money and not try to evaluate the marriage market or evaluate the family choices or evaluate religion, which is one of your research topics. So can you help us understand why it might not be a bad thing, why it is good to extend and expand our understanding of economics to include all of relationships, all purposeful action? How is that beneficial as opposed to maybe, you know, stripping down the important unmeasurables, you know, economizing on love? Is that a good thing? Should we economize on love? Shouldn't the butcher and the baker make their things for you out of love rather than because they're self-interested? How should we understand this puzzle?
So there's a lot there. Yeah. So what I would say first is that no science, no subject of inquiry or method of inquiry is going to be able to get at the full truth, right? Or the full way of understanding reality. And so that's another important thing to recognize, the division of labor in the disciplines. And even theology has, you know, it's queen of the sciences, but it has its own place, right? It can't tell us things about economics in the way economics can and those tools can. So it's really important to actually keep that division of labor straight in our minds, I think. And so while economics can't tell you, you know, the full truth about something like the marriage market, why people form families, for instance, it can give you really important insights that might be missed by other sciences just because they don't have the same tools. And so I think that this is something in my own research, I've just been fascinated by the way that we can use economic tools, thinking about specialization and trade, for instance, in the household, to illuminate our understanding of something like what divorce does to a family, or you know, why it's so important to have different talents in the household, to have a mother and a father, right? Things like this can actually help us understand the way that these realities are. So whenever, I've been working on a project on the medieval marriage contract, and I call it a contract. And I always am quick to say in speaking that obviously I don't believe it's just a contract, right? But it is a contract at some level, right? This agreement to get married and to vow, you know, loyalty and for the rearing of children and everything for life. So I think that that's one way to think of it, is we're not trying to describe all of reality. We never can. So we're just using some tools to try to understand pieces of it. And economics is really good at understanding things like exchange, right? Exchange relationships, purposive action by humans, right? All of that kind of thing. Yeah. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. And I think that behind that last bit about purposive action, I think it's almost, there's almost some assumptions underlying there that we aren't caught in a materialist trap, that we actually are able to make free choices, that we have free will. I mean, this is some basics of the Catholic Catechism, that we have understanding and free will, right? If you assume that we don't have free will, if you assume that humans are bad for the planet, if you assume, you know, some of these negative assumptions, is economics as a starting place making correct assumptions and then trying to, you know, reason from there? If you start from the opposite of we have no free will and humans are bad for the planet, what does that do to the way you might approach economics or even the rest of life?
That's right. I think you're picking up on something that I wasn't able to get to in the article that I wrote for Public Discourse, but that I want to someday, which is that I think the economic assumptions about the human person are much more classical and much more Christian and even Catholic, even Thomistic than even economists realize. I think most economists, you know, just it's a very common sense understanding of the human person, right? Mm-hmm. It takes a philosopher in an ivory tower to say, maybe we don't have free will, right? Most people, right, act as if and think we do have free will. So it's a very common sense understanding. A lot of the assumptions that economists make actually are very commonsensical. And for that reason, I think get a lot of things right that other sciences have forgotten. So one of the main, I think, value contributions of economics to the larger conversation is in studying the human person as a person, an agent with free will, an agent who is not totally self-sufficient, right? Not completely autonomous, not completely independent, but dependent, and also just isn't omniscient, right? Knows some things better than they know others. And so I think that it's really important to recover this understanding. And even Thomas Aquinas would write, and this is from Aristotle as well, right? Man chooses towards a perceived good. And so a lot of the times, and I like to focus on the word perceived sometimes, because I think economists talk a lot about kind of what is and what is the case. And people mistake that for us saying maybe what ought to be the case. And the fact that humans choose purposively doesn't mean that we won't choose wrong, right? Wrongly. Right. But it means that we think, right, that we're making the right choice in that moment. And so there's definitely a lot, I think, of classical wisdom that's actually underlying economic assumptions, which is why, as you got to and what you were saying just now, which is why we can avoid some pitfalls, some really basic pitfalls, like saying, you know, the environment is the most important thing and that people, you know, are completely, you know, kind of a materialistic reality is the one that pervades, right? That's not the viewpoint of economics, actually.
Let's go back to the roots of economics. If we want to say that economics belongs in the classical canon, How far back does economics go? Do we see economics in Aristotle? Do we see Aquinas? You mentioned Aquinas already. Does it have deeper roots? We think of Adam Smith, father of modern economics, but how deep do these roots go? And in your article at the end, you mentioned that there are ways to read individuals who weren't pure economists, and you're getting some economic insights blended with other insights. So who should we turn to there, and how can we work this into a curriculum potentially?
Yeah, no, very good. So actually, my first research article that I published when I was a grad student was on this question, because I'm very convinced actually by this economic historian, Joseph Schumpeter, who wrote this big, big book on the history of economic analysis. And he starts really with Aristotle and some of the classics. And he says, there's definitely economic content here, but it's not until the late scholastics. So this is before Adam Smith, which even Adam Smith was a moral philosopher. People forget that his most famous book was The Theory of Moral Sentiments, not The Wealth of Nations. And so it's important to keep that straight too. There were no, you know, economics wasn't a definitive science even then. But before that, in the 16th century in Spain, there's this school, sometimes called the School of Salamanca, or the late scholastics, this group of professor priests, really, who were teaching using scholasticism, which had come from the University of Paris, and trying to answer questions of business ethics. And Schumpeter said, and actually a lot of people in the Austrian economics tradition also adhered to this, they said that was the start of economic analysis. Why? Well, because what they did is they made economic discoveries. So not only did they observe, and they even kept sometimes empirics on different exchange rates or inflation, right? The price of bread, because they were concerned about poor people in their parishes, but they went on to actually discover economic theories, such as the quantity theory of money, we would say, or the subjective theory of value are two big examples. And essentially the way that they stumbled into this was taking this classical view of the human person and applying it to business matters, which were really important at the time, because in 16th century Spain, there's a lot of trade with the New World, and there was a lot of inflation from the influx of gold. And then there were also these policies from the king that were really harming the poor and the church, actually. And so they were really vocal in writing about these topics and almost unintentionally stumbled upon a lot of things we would recognize today as very good economics.
And those insights are still worth teaching. It's not that, you know, they got us towards now we can teach 20th century economics, but we could still go back and take School of Salamanca insights and teach them to high school students.
100%. In fact, I prefer to teach it that way when I teach it in class, because I think it's more common sense. They were talking in a lot of their writings, they were writing to merchants, to business people, to people in the confessional. Actually, they had some of these insights in confessor manuals. And so they're very, very approachable writings. And they were in the vernacular and, like, you know, kind of old Spanish too. And so it's very approachable and it's very commonsensical. Again, they use a lot of examples of, you know, just agriculture or family life. And so I absolutely would, you know, advocate bringing those writings back into education.
Maybe someone needs to make a reader of these great excerpts that could be used specifically in a high school classical classroom.
That's a $1 million idea right there. That's
wink, good. Wink. Yeah. So I was involved in the making of the CLT Author Bank, which is the authors from which we draw text to put on our exam for reading comprehension, grammar, those sorts of things. And we have, say, 6 economists on there. And I would love to hear whether you think we got the list right, or if there's other people you think that we should swap out. Not that we will, but just we've got Smith and Hume, who were contemporaries. We've got Marx and John Stuart Mill. And then we've got Hayek and Keynes. So we've kind of got three different eras represented, 2 from each era. What do you think of that 6-pack of economists on the CLT Author Bank?
I think that's pretty good. I mean, you have a lot of coverage there. Smart to pair them, because as anyone who knows economic history knows that it's a history of big debates and very, you know, fierce debates. And so there are a lot of areas where those thinkers disagreed. And so it's helpful to cover territory there. Yeah, the only thing, I always pitch the late scholastics to people. So, you know, they're my favorite. I think it's phenomenal and really interesting how they came before Smith, and the physiocrats were also sort of in there. You mentioned Bastiat before. Bastiat's so good. But if you have to choose just 6, I think that's a good list.
Great. Fantastic. We've already talked a little bit about adding economists without crowding out, you know, literature, without crowding out philosophy, that there are ways to blend that. Is there anything else you'd like to share to, say, a classroom teacher or an administrator about the incorporation of these ideas? I mean, we don't want to overload students. You know, they've already gotten a lot of summer reading, you know, without giving them a whole summer of economics, for example. So what's the best way to dovetail without losing the restful learning that many of our schools celebrate?
Yeah, so it's tough, because I do think that the classical curriculum has so much of value in it. I don't want to take away from it, but I will say that a little economics goes a long way. And so that's one of the things that I closed my article with, is I want to say, you know, really one book or one essay even, you know, can really round out a student's understanding of when they're reading literature, or especially history. I found that history is actually a really good place to kind of talk about some of these things, and just thinking about, okay, well, you know, with international trade or different topics that go on, can be a nice place to insert some of the analysis. But I would really recommend Thomas Sowell. Actually, he's alive right now, a contemporary thinker who I always go back to. And he's written a lot of approachable books on economics. His book, Basic Economics, is very good, kind of large, but very good. And a lot of these things I think, complement really nicely a classical education. So it doesn't have to be anything crazy. It doesn't even necessarily have to be a dedicated class. I understand, again, time is our scarcest resource. There are a lot of important things to get through in a classical curriculum that I would not want to, you know, replace, but it can be, you know, something like summer reading, or even, you know, kind of a complement to maybe a history class or something like that. I've also seen this done well. I will say this. Another option, if it's a Catholic or a Christian classical school, I've seen economics paired really nicely with philosophy, actually, or with just as a Catholic social thought kind of module. And so that's another way to think about it, is, well, maybe again, not a dedicated course to economics, but let's talk about, you know, maybe Catholic social thought, which actually has a good deal of economics in it, because you need to, you know, have a correct understanding of economics to make some prescriptions. So that's sort of how I'm starting. I wrote the article before I had fully fleshed out some of these details, right? How I would implement this on the ground.
Yeah.
So my final appeal is, you know, I'm just a professor. I'm not good with the details, but that would be my inclination.
I think maybe the fact that it pairs so well with history or philosophy or theology or government, if you're doing a policy type, you know,
certainly
that makes the case for its centrality. I mean, mm-hmm. something that can be all of these things really is central to the ways that we interact with other people, which then, you know, spools out into, you could do literature and kind of do, you know, look at the economic interactions in Jane Austen. We're reading as a company Sense and Sensibility right now. There's all kinds of economics in there. It's wild. So I think students really are missing out on a beautiful analysis if they're not getting it paired with any of those things, if it's just a hole in the middle, as you mentioned.
Yeah. And I would even say that sometimes it's not even a vacuum. My real concern actually in writing this article, and it's kind of from personal experience and with people I've known, is that we all will have a theory in our minds of how prices work, how markets work, how the economy works, mm-hmm. and how policy works. That's mm-hmm. not, you know, that's not just something we can't live without having some ideas about that. And so we have to be careful, because some textbooks, and I'll just give an example from a recent research article that found that in the majority of history textbooks, the explanations for the Great Depression are ones that economists would not agree with, that have been so debunked or would have never come up with, things like saying it was overproduction or underconsumption, or just really sort of confused theories about this really important period in American history. Whereas in economics textbooks, obviously the explanation is very different. There are a couple of theories, but it's really narrow. There's a lot of agreement as on a lot of things from an economic perspective when it comes to economic history. And so even just making sure when you're choosing your textbooks or choosing your curriculum, just being informed about, okay, well, are we, you know, imparting the correct sort of economic approach, or is this a place where we should say, hey, actually, you know, there's, economists would look at this differently, maybe, you know, maybe it's still a good text to use, or maybe it's still, you know, a great essay to read or something like that. But to say, you know, that there is actually a different take, I think is really important, because it's really when we imbibe knowledge and then we don't know that we're working from that assumption, right? That the Great Depression was this kind of problem and it's that kind of problem, where it can be pretty dangerous for us as thinkers and actors.
Yeah. I mentioned I was excited to ask you about bad economics or bad economists. I think that could take us a long time. So I'm just going to switch and just cast this in a positive light and ask, what does the world look like? What does the country look like if we actually had 100% economic literacy? And you can define that how you like, but not just that people are forced through a class in high school and, you know, they get the right answers on a test, but that they really have the sense of wonder and insight into economics on some fundamental level, not advanced, but that they grasp, you know, 3-5 key insights in economics. If everybody had that, how would that change the world? What would the world look like?
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing to think about. And I had never thought about it before your question, but I do think that just starting at sort of an everyday level, I think that economics gives you a real appreciation just for our common duties or our common tasks. So just in doing my job, showing up to work, like for instance, one of my first jobs ever was as a Starbucks barista in high school. And I loved it. I loved it so much. It was a wonderful job. But looking back now, and I had a sense of this actually in at that time, but looking back, I can say with pride, you know, that I was serving people, you know, their coffee, which they probably really needed and that they probably really valued, to so they could go on, right? I was contributing a small portion of value to their day. So I think that just if we, you know, had more economic literacy, everyday people would do their everyday duties with more pride and more of a sense of, okay, this is actually how I am part of the human family, you know, because we all need a sense of responsibility. We all need a sense of belonging, and we all need a sense of purpose. And we don't have to construct it. That's the thing, is we don't have to make up jobs for people. We don't have to make up responsibilities. There's a ton already there. There's more than enough, right? So just recognizing that, doing your job, feeding your child over and over again, changing a diaper over and over again, super humbling, but also like really important and really a source of value in the world, mm-hmm. in the economy. And so recognizing that, I think, is just something I'm really passionate about. But also, I mean, we can move up, you know, levels, thinking about politics obviously would look very different, I think, if voters were economically mm-hmm. informed or had more economic literacy, even more statistical literacy, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I really think that, you know, we would understand and come to appreciate, this is from Thomas Sowell, that there are no solutions, there's only trade-offs, right? So mm-hmm. at the end of the day, we don't live in a perfect world, and there's always going to be really good things that we can't afford or we can't do because we'd be sacrificing better things for them. So I really think it would help us, you know, think more realistically about the world that we live in.
Mm, amazing answer. And one that could be its own podcast. I mean, it's just, that could be a whole conversation. But thank you for joining us today. We have one final question that we offer to all of our guests. And that is, what is the all-time most influential text, book, could be thinker, but especially book, something that we could recommend, something that you often come back to revisit? So for that, what is that for you?
Yeah. So for me, it's probably this little red book called The Intellectual Life by this French Dominican. It's very, very small and very cute, very good. Yep. He's holding it up right now. Wonderful. So I had a person who had gone through the George Mason program recommend it to me as a fellow Catholic. And I got it my first semester because I knew, hey, this is going to be really hard work. I need to remember why I'm doing it. Right? That Frankl line. I could say Man's Search for Meaning. Man's Search for Meaning is also really good, but like that Frankl line, right? We need that purpose. And so I kept it with me. I read it a bunch of times. I gifted it to my now husband when we were in grad school. And it's just been with me ever since. I use a quote from it on the first day of every class that I teach, which is that to remind students essentially that you're part of this great conversation. You're an intellectual being. You have this intellectual life, and college isn't about, you know, only it can be about getting a job and establishing connections and networks and things like that. But remember that there's more to you, right, than that. And so I want to speak to that. I want to make you fall in love with this subject. And I want to acknowledge that, you know, you're a thinking person, and that's something very beautiful. So that's probably the most influential book for me, especially at this point in my life.
A wonderful answer. Jeremy, our CEO, just read it this year. I've read it. Our CTO, he introduced both of us to it. So something I think we're all very excited to pass on to our listeners. And Dr. Clara Piano, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Anchored. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to leave a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. And remember to subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.